It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, how to pack an awesome picnic for summer, which, you know, is going to happen sometime soon.
But first, the National Institutes of Health this week called for an end to what it calls routine gender bias in basic research.
According to the NIH, women are underrepresented in clinical trials carried out by drug companies and medical device manufacturers. The result? Women might experience more severe side effects from new treatments, and some treatments may not be as effective.
So why is there gender bias in research, and what are the effects on women? The NIH's Janine Clayton joins us now to explain more. She's the Associate Director for Research on Women's Health and the Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at NIH. Janine, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, for a long time, getting women included in clinical trials and medical research has been a goal. Now the NIH is saying, and you're saying, it needs to start earlier than that. It can't just happen when we're at a clinical trial phase, for instance. Where are we now when it comes to gender bias in medical research?
What we know is women are included in clinical research that's supported by NIH. And in fact, there are over 50% of those that are participants in NIH-supported clinical research are women. But what we don't see is in the preclinical studies, those studies where we're looking to test a drug or a procedure or a treatment to see if it might be useful, what we're seeing is that we don't see males and females there. And scientists don't look routinely for differences between males and females because it's sort of like a blind spot for them.
So what is the idea here, then, that most of the trials, or certainly if we go back to the animal research phase where a lot of this research starts, that it's all male animals, and is the idea then that, you know, a male is similar enough to a female that it's not necessary to include females?
Unfortunately, there are some people who think that, and there are also some people who think incorrectly that including animals, female animals, will cause variability in their research experiments and it will disrupt their experiments. We show in our paper, citing a meta-analysis, a collection of multiple studies, in fact, that is just not true. Males and females are no more variable than males, and in fact, in these animal studies, males have more variability than females in certain traits.
And one of the things I understand that researchers are worried about is adjusting for hormone cycles in females.
Exactly. That's what they think causes the variability. And this study nicely showed even when you don't account for the cycle, the females in these studies, the female rodents, were no more variable than the males. In fact, things like dominance behaviors, fighting amongst the males in the cages, those things caused even more variability in the males than you would ever see in the females.
So how does this impact women? So at the end of the road, let's say you start with your research on lab animals, and when everything has gone through its processes, you have, say, a drug on the market. So how does this affect women that we're seeing so much testing done on male animals?
Unfortunately, what this leads to is a gap in our knowledge. So we just don't know as much about how a compound, a drug, or a therapy might affect a woman's cells or tissues. And so when we don't know as much, we can't be as sure about the safety or the efficacy, whether a drug will work in women as well as it does in men. We know that drugs have different effects in men and women. For example, aspirin helps to prevent heart attack in men, but really works to prevent stroke in women. So we don't know everything if we have these half-truths, half-stories coming out instead of the whole story.
And there were some fairly recent news right about a sleeping drugs, a drug that helped women get to sleep, and men that was metabolized differently by women.
Exactly. Zolpidem, a drug that is used for sleep, it's metabolized, it's cleared rather more slowly in women. And so the drug was still around the next morning after a woman took this the night before, and that resulted in some changes in her ability to do some tasks the next morning. So I would applaud the FDA and colleagues for identifying the fact that there was a sex difference there, that the situation was different for men and women, and acting on that.
And there are certain medical conditions that affect women more than men, things like anxiety and depression and thyroid disease, multiple sclerosis. What happens then in terms of which gender these drugs get tested on?
Sure. Too many of the times, despite the fact that a condition is more common in women than men, the animal studies that are being performed by the scientists still use predominantly male animal models. So despite the fact that, as you mentioned, depression is more common in women than men, the depression animal model that is being used to test a drug or to study the disease is more commonly a male animal. And even worse, in some cases, the publications that result from those studies don't report the sex of the animals that they were using in the studies. And that's a big problem because it makes it very difficult for other scientists to try to duplicate or verify those research findings.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, I haven't read anything about it in what you've written so far, but as we know, there's a big push to get girls interested in the STEM fields, women going into the STEM fields. And I'm assuming, and maybe incorrectly, you can let me know, but that a lot of these researchers are male themselves. Does that have anything to do with it?
There really is no suggestion that it's related to the sex of the investigator. This is a problem in science, and it's a problem beyond NIH. It's a problem for our scientific community. That's why we really need our medical education colleagues, those who are in the publishing realm, journal editors, our clinical colleagues who take care of patients, and all of us need to be working together to get a solution to this issue.
So what is the solution to the issue? How do we get this testing to be done on both male and female animals?
As we move forward, we're going to be asking our investigators to embark upon a balanced approach in addressing male and female differences in cells and animals to make sure that men and women get the full benefit of the medical research. And again, the reason why we're doing that and what we want to share with others is that sex, being male or female, is a fundamental variable in biomedical research that really must be considered from the very start.
Now, the NIH has appealed to researchers in the past for not including sufficient numbers of women in clinical trials. How is that going?
Right now, over 50% of those participants in NIH-supported clinical research are women. So that's where we are. That applies to NIH-supported clinical research. There's certainly research that's done by other entities and then supported by the pharmaceutical industry and other entities.
Why has it taken so long for this issue to really get traction and begin to be corrected?
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer to that question as to why it's taking it so long. All I can say is that it hasn't happened, it hasn't been enough of a priority, and that's why we're moving forward now to take action on multiple fronts. So we'll be issuing training modules, we'll be developing policies that will start rolling out in the next fiscal year. We are continuing, actually, to fund some supplements where we provide NIH grantees, scientists doing NIH research now, we provide them with additional funds so they can add male or female animals to their current experiments or add males or females to their human experiments and do additional analyses. And we'll be monitoring our review process and oversight processes as well.
Some of the concerns that I've seen raised about these new guidelines have been that it's going to cost more money and that you may need, as a researcher, double the number of animals that you're working with. How does the NIH respond to that?
More than a numbers game. What we're talking about is a balanced approach in addressing these male and female differences in cells and animals in preclinical studies where, by design, those are studies that are done to try to see if a drug or a procedure is likely to be useful in people, in human beings who get this condition, and they're men and women who get this condition. So this is more than a numbers game, and in fact, the best money that we can spend is related to us doing the best science, and the optimal experimental design involves considering males and female differences in preclinical research.
So how optimistic are you, and how optimistic is the NIH in general, that you're going to get buy-in on this and that you're going to be able to affect real change within a relatively short period of time?
Scientists are about getting good data, and I think that as we share information about the value of considering the influence of sex on the data that scientists are obtaining in their experiments and when they understand the potential influence of sex on the outcome of their experiments, we're going to see a shift. We're going to see a change in mindset about that. We're anxious to have these conversations and to work together with our colleagues to share best practices about how to do this, because I think there is a need out for getting that word out, and we're happy to do that.
Well, Janine, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Janine Clayton, Associate Director for Research on Women's Health and the Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at National Institutes of Health. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Here in Wisconsin, we're coming up on picnic season, or so we'd like to imagine, when the weather permits. So for this Food Friday, we decided to give a call to WPR's own Lori Skelton about her favorite picnic foods.
And as usual, Lori threw herself into the task at hand. She's been making delicious fare, already getting geared up for this segment on picnic food. And she's here today to share what she's learned about picnicking. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here on this topic, definitely.
So, Lori, what do you think is the perfect picnic food? What makes good picnic food?
Well, I tend to go for relatively simple things. I do a fair amount of picnic dinners in the summer because I spend a fair amount of time at APT. Mm-hmm. And there are some weekends that I go to more than one play, and there isn't a lot of time to put together anything elaborate. So, I mean, you start off with the basics, a loaf of good bread, a couple of hunks of really good cheese. I think we can find some of that in Wisconsin. Some delicious meat, the best fruit that's at the farmer's market. Just throw that in the basket along with a good bottle of wine and you're set. I guess for me, I look for picnic fare that is tasty, but doesn't require too much fussing once you get there, which is why the recipes that I wanted to talk about today ended up really sparking some interest in people thinking, oh, we can get a little more elaborate, but it doesn't have to be a full-out production number.
Before we get to the recipes, the gear. One of the samples you brought, you had a cutting board. It seemed vital. Bringing a cutting board to a picnic, I wouldn't always think of it, but it seems like a great idea.
And it's one of those things that you can leave in your vehicle. It really doesn't take up that much room. You may want to take the knife out of your vehicle in between times, but a cutting board, especially a sturdy plastic one, shouldn't be in the way at all.
Because I've been doing the dangerous cutting cheese in my hand, you know, because there's nowhere to put it.
No, it's
risky.
Especially because you're never sure, even if you do have a picnic table, how steady that is. Mm. And if you've got a wobbly picnic table and you're trying to slice something on it, that could get dangerous.
Right. Well, let's get to the good stuff. Yeah. Let's talk about the recipes. And one that you brought in for everybody to try was from Cooks Illustrated, and it was called Spice Rubbed Picnic Chicken. Now, this is up on the Central Time Facebook page if you want to get cooking already. What is this recipe? How does it work?
When we were talking about doing this program, I asked a lot of people, so what's your favorite thing to take on a picnic? And a lot of people said, well, what's wrong with good old-fashioned fried chicken? There's nothing wrong with it, except that by the time you've fried your chicken and then transported it to your picnic site, it's going to be cold, and it's going to taste that cold, greasy, doesn't always translate well into a picnic. So this was a recipe that was sent to me earlier in the year. Somebody suggested we may want to try this. It's a great chicken that has elements of barbecue sauce in it, except it's not sticky. And we specifically tried this recipe, served it at room temperature. The chicken didn't taste fatty or flabby. It had great flavor on the skin and on the meat as well. And so it's a combination of salt and spices and brown sugar. And that's what's going to give you that feel of a barbecue sauce without the drip, drip, drip all over the place.
It had a little zing to it. What kind of spices were involved here?
There was chili powder. I used a medium heat of chili. Sweet paprika, black pepper, and cayenne.
So it's kind of like a barbecue sauce without the sauce.
Exactly.
Interesting, without the tomato sauce in it.
Exactly. And we had several people who tried it here on staff say that it needed more salt. Now, I admit...
Wrong. They are wrong. Ignore them.
The chili powder that I use doesn't have as much salt as some commercial blends, so you may have to play around with that. The other thing that was suggested, if you want smokier flavor rather than heat, skip the cayenne and use ground chipotle powder.
Ooh. I would like to try that, yeah. But I like the spice mix as it was. I don't like things too salty, so I was not wanting more salt on that.
What was delightful to me was that I had a lot of responses that started off, I'm normally a wimp about spices, but this was a great heat level. Mm-hmm. It didn't blow my lips off, but it still was interesting. And the way this particular setup works is you're using the spice rub as what is called a dry brine or a dry rub. You put this on the night before and then bake the chicken the next morning. So this will crisp up the skin by air drying it out, but it also allows that spice mixture to get on the meat. And I did hear from a lot of people, it it really permeated all the way through down to the bone. We did chicken drumsticks for the staff here. And again, not requiring a lot of utensils. You just pick up a drumstick and eat, and it's perfect.
Did you say regular paprika or smoked?
This was sweet paprika.
Because I'm a huge fan of smoked paprika, and I bet that would be another way you could get at that little bit of smoky taste.
What you're going to get with smoked paprika, it's not going to taste as much like a smoky American barbecue sauce. It's going to taste more European. It's going to taste more old world. It sounds like a great idea, but again, you're
so
playing.
We can tinker here.
Absolutely.
Well, again, we've got a link to that spice-rubbed picnic chicken available at the Central Time Facebook page. Check it out. Make it. Let us know how it went at your next picnic. You brought another one, and I really like this. And I've been saying muffaletta. You've been saying muffaletta.
I've heard it both ways.
So it's the sandwich. It's from Italy via New Orleans.
Isn't it muffaletta?
Muffaletta.
Muffaletta. It's Sicilian, and it starts off with the bread, a Sicilian round seeded bread that you slice in half and you hollow out so you can pack this thing full of ham and mortadella and salami and provolone, and some people use mozzarella. And what you need to do is have some sort of vegetable with a vinaigrette in it. The traditional sandwich has what they call olive salad, chopped olives with maybe carrots, maybe celery, maybe some cauliflower. A good giardiniera is a good example of what you might put on a muffaletta. And so you dry out your bread a little bit. If it's a day or two stale, that's perfect. And then you put on some of the vinaigrette, and you layer on your meats and cheeses, and you put on more of the vinaigrette, and you wrap it up. And this is where I think it makes a great thing for a picnic for a crowd. You wrap it up well, and it can sit in the refrigerator until you're absolutely ready to go. And then once you get to your picnic site, you unwrap it, and you've got this lovely sandwich with all of that great vinaigrette soaked into the bread.
And another thing you did that was kind of genius is that you hollowed out the bread so that it didn't sort of ooze out the side.
Exactly.
It was a very tidy little sandwich.
Yes, as we did find out that you can't slice a muffaletta too small. You need to have a fairly sizable hunk of sandwich in your hand. Otherwise, it can fall apart. But yes, having that hollow in the bread will hold everything. And the one I made for the staff, I cheated a little bit. Rather than use an olive salad, I mixed up some olive tapenade with vinaigrette and then just used jarred red peppers. I also added arugula, which technically is not the way the Sicilians would do it, but I liked having that green crunch.
Well, one of the things I liked about this is it's a sandwich. It's something you can really make however you want it. You can jazz up. I really liked the olive tapenade on that. I thought that was a great touch.
Okay, good.
What other reactions did you hear from the other folks here?
One person asked, so what's the difference between a muffaletta and a po' boy? Can't you take a po' boy on a picnic? Technically, if you're going to have a po' boy, those are served hot. And those are often served with mayonnaise. And I tend to stay away from things that have mayo when you're going on a picnic.
Mm.
But it seemed to, again, good heat level, and it seemed to go over really, really well with the staff.
I loved it. I have a huge sandwich crush on this. Seriously, like,
really
I keep
good.
Thinking about, when can I make it? Is it warm enough to have a picnic? So well, I'm going to say everyone needs to try the sandwich.
Who's to say you can't have a picnic on a blanket in your living room?
Yeah,
well, Lori, briefly, we've got to wash these meals down. What kind of wine?
Well, there is one summer wine that goes perfectly with just about any picnic fare, and that's a dry rosé. Not White Zinfandel. That's going to be a little too sweet. But somebody sent to me their favorite thing for a picnic, which is a vegetable and cold noodle salad that's dressed with sesame oil, tamari, peanut butter, balsamic vinegar, honey, and chili sauce. And I knew it was going to be delicious, but I'd never tried anything with an Asian flavor and rosé. Tried it last night. It's amazing. So rosé goes with just about, I've had it with chicken. I've had it with burgers. I've had it with sausage. I've had it with cheese. Rosé in your picnic basket all the way.
Oh, sounds lovely. Well, anything else that we should toss in there? So we've got our muffaletta. We've got our spice-rubbed chicken and our rosé.
A quick last tip to leave us with?
I would go to the farmer's market or your neighbor down the road, get the best fruit you can, and then do nothing with it. This fresh fruit is the absolute perfect way to end a picnic, in my opinion.
Fresh fruit for dessert. Great.
Absolutely.
Well, Lori, as always, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your culinary expertise.
My pleasure.
That was Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies here at WPR. Next week for Food Friday, speaking of beverages, an iconic spirit of America, bourbon. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about a political scientist, talk with a political scientist about possible changes to Wisconsin's campaign finance laws.
First, our next guest asks the same question Edwin Starr did in the song we're hearing, War, what is it good for? But unlike the song, his answer is rather a lot, really.
He makes the case that despite all the horrors of war, it's done a lot of good for humanity in the form of complex societies, advanced technology, and less violent lives and deaths.
Ian Morris is with us now. He's professor of classics and professor of history at Stanford University, a fellow of the Stanford Archaeological Center. His new book is War, What Is It Good For? Ian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, this idea that war has made humans safer seems a little counterintuitive. I want to break it down some. First, you say we're less likely to die of violence now than in, say, prehistoric times, even with all the deaths brought about by war in the last century or so. Really?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's hard for us to grasp this when you pick up the newspaper every morning or check on your computer or whatever, you hear about all these terrible things going on. But I mean, actually, while I was waiting on the phone for the show to start, I was listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio news, and the lead announcement they had was, you know, there's been 34 gun homicides so far this year in Wisconsin. There's about nearly six million people in Wisconsin. And obviously there's other ways of killing people, murdering people apart from just shooting them. But you're talking about a rate of violent death in Wisconsin, somewhere in the order of one in every 2,000 people. If you lived in the Stone Age, your chance of dying violently was somewhere between one in five and one in 10, so far as we can tell. Just astronomically higher rates of violent death. Even in the 20th century, with two world wars, nuclear weapons get used, genocides get committed. There's somewhere between 100 and 200 million people die violently in the 20th century, but 10 billion people lived during the century. So that's a rate of about 1 to 2%, you know, 10 times safer than during the Stone Age. So, yeah, in a way, this is the single biggest story in human history about how the world got safer and safer.
Well, and let's take it step by step now. You say war makes states, you know, the governments, nations, and states make peace. How so?
That's right, yeah. This is hardly a new argument. This idea has been kind of floating around since the 17th century, since Thomas Hobbes wrote his book Leviathan. It's just that now I think we've got the archaeological and historical evidence to really be able to see what's been going on. And this is a story that goes back about 10,000 years to the end of the last ice age. And the world warms up and population starts to grow and farming starts and the world starts getting more and more crowded. And as that happens, if two tribes go to war and one side starts losing, in the old days, you could always run away and go off and hunt and gather and stuff in someplace else because the world is really very uncrowded. But as the world gets fuller, it gets harder to do that. And so we start seeing this process where the people who win a war will often swallow up the society that they defeat to make a single bigger society. And it's a really nasty process, always involves lots of violence, you know, and terrible things happen. But what then happens is, like, say you're the guy who is ruling this bigger society, and what you really want in the world is for the people you rule to get up tomorrow morning and go out and plow their fields and pay their taxes and just behave quietly and not give you a lot of trouble. What you really don't want is for every time a farmer falls out with his next-door neighbor, he pulls out a knife and stabs the guy and burns his farm down and kills all his cattle. That, of course, is going to be a disaster for the rulers. So it's like there's this selective pressure on rulers to pacify the societies they rule. And the more they do that, the more they flourish as rulers. And, of course, lots of rulers don't fit this generalization. You know, there's plenty of guys like Hitler out there doing absolutely, you know, destructive, terrible things. But over the really long run, over 10,000 years, this pressure is enough to keep pushing societies toward being more and more pacified. And the result of this is this 90% decline in rates of violent death.
So when we look back at ancient history, even up through the Roman Empire, we maybe focus a lot on the edges and all the wars and invasions and conquests. But you're saying that an expanding zone of peace outweighs the zone of violence that led to it.
Yeah, I think this is a pattern you see over and over again in history, whether you're talking about the Roman Empire or about the European colonists coming and conquering North America, that you get this expansion, which is almost always a really violent process. You know, the Romans invade Gaul, say, or Europeans come and settle in Wisconsin, and there's lots of violence, lots of terrible things happen. But then you come back again and look at the same place a couple of hundred years later. What you regularly find, you again, whether it's Roman, Gaul, or Wisconsin now, what you regularly find is the rates of violent death are way lower than they were before the conquest. And also the people, on the whole, are more prosperous. They get brought into these bigger societies. There's a lot more trade, a more sophisticated division of labor, and levels of prosperity go up as a consequence of the peace. So, yeah, I mean, it is a totally counterintuitive sort of thing. But I think this is often the case when you go up from short-term history of what we experience in our daily lives up to looking at the really big picture, the nature of the whole thing changes.
So can't we, though, get this ever-growing state, this zone of peace, without war? Isn't there some other path to get there?
Yeah, that, I mean, that would be great. I mean, in the song, Edwin Starr has this line, "Lord knows there's got to be a better way." But the really depressing thing I found when I was writing this book is when you look back across history, it's really hard to find examples of people just like peacefully sitting down together and saying, you know, if we get together, we form this larger organization, we can have, you know, more trade, more prosperity, more peace. Everybody will be better off. And you know, you would think rationally, surely this is the way humans will have done things. But you look back across 10,000 years of history, it's really difficult to find examples of societies doing this without violence and force being involved somewhere.
Well, but haven't things like, you know, organizing how we're going to use the Nile to irrigate the local desert, or we're going to get a trade league together to improve trade. Doesn't that lead to some of the things you're talking about?
Well, again, you look back over the long story. It's really hard to find examples of this working very well on a large scale without somebody being there to enforce it. And this is one of the things, like 200 years ago when 250 years ago when Adam Smith is writing The Wealth of Nations, you know, his big thing in that is that the real source of wealth is making bigger and bigger markets, you know, freeing people up to truck and barter as their natural disposition makes them want to do, exchange goods, have a more sophisticated division of labor, everybody gets richer. And Smith, the insight Smith is remembered for is, of course, you know, if for markets to work well, governments have got to get out of the market and leave people alone to get on with things. But what he also said that we often forget is for markets to work at all, governments have got to get into them, because somebody has got to enforce the rules and prevent the bullies who, you know, maybe can't compete as well in a fair marketplace, so they show up with a gun and say, you know, I'll just take the stuff. Somebody has got to prevent that from happening. And you know, again, in principle, there's no reason why, you know, peaceful pressure shouldn't be enough to prevent people trying to use violence to solve their problems. But when you look back across history, it's really difficult to find examples of this being successful.
You've alluded to your next step already. War makes states. States make peace. War seems to be the only thing that leads there. And when this happens, we end up richer and more prosperous.
Yeah, that seems to be the big story. And but I think there's a couple of really interesting lessons that come out of looking at you know, this big pattern in history. And one of the most important ones, I think, is the way the whole relationship has mutated and evolved over these 10,000 years. And you go back, you know, far enough back as far as our records go, on the whole, there's just an awful lot of violence involved in making these bigger societies work. In modern times, there's a lot less violence involved in making them work. And modern societies, we're so much more integrated now. We've developed so much more sophisticated democratic ways of doing things that a lot of the time, there's a lot less state violence than there used to be. But I think the other big lesson that comes out of this story is we're not yet at a point where we can just say, oh, we have transcended force. There's not going to be any more need for force in the world. I mean, you just look at what happened in Crimea the last few weeks with Vladimir Putin. There are still people out there who are ready to use force to get what they want. And because of that, the stability of the world does still depend on having somebody able to kind of police the global order.
Well, and but you do make the case that maybe we're heading toward a point where the evolution of war is making war more untenable in the future.
Yeah, I think, again, this is one of the kind of the big picture conclusions that you come to. In a sense, in the really long run, you can say that violence has been self-defeating, that this sort of unexpected side effect of people fighting each other in the Stone Age has been the creation of these bigger and bigger organizations, these societies. And this has been driven by violence, but the effect of it has been to make violence pay off less and less well. So, I mean, I think in a way, this is a very depressing story about how important violence has been in human development. But in another way, it's quite an uplifting story, that the violence does seem to be self-defeating in the really long term.
We're talking to Ian Morris about his new book. It's called War, What Is It Good For? He makes the case that overall war has actually played a positive role in human history and human development. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Wickert. We continue our conversation about war with Ian Morris. In his new book, War, What Is It Good For? He says war has played a vital role in the development of human institutions and has ultimately done more good than harm.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this idea? Do you have questions about how it fits into your understanding of human history? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Came back in with War Pigs by Black Sabbath, a real standard at public radio. Ian, this is, you say, the first song you mastered on the guitar. It's an anti-war song. You were not a military kind of guy, a war kind of guy. Are you surprised that you found yourself making a case for the positive side of war?
Yeah. I mean, I think this often happens when you start writing a book. You know, it takes several years to write a book, and you get this idea, and you go out and start doing the research. And I find more often than not, things turn out very differently from what I expected going into this, going into the writing. And I think particularly so in the case of this one. I mean, if somebody had told me 10 or 15 years ago, let alone back in the days when I was trying to learn to play War Pigs, that I would have written a book making this argument, I would have been very, very surprised.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Sean on the line in Kenosha. Sean, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment about, you know, history. This is just something that I've read, that it's kind of human nature to look back at history and connect the dots and see things in a linear fashion, when in fact things may not be as connected as we think. So I guess my question is, if we look at very specific situations of war and peace, does your theory still hold up? I guess that's my question.
Gotcha. Thanks, Sean. I heard the dogs of war in the background. Ian, what do you say to that?
I think somebody came to the front door and set the dogs off. I think this is something you see very clearly when you try to look at this big story, that the experience of actually living through war is very, very different from the impact that wars have had over tens of thousands of years. And one part of this is, you know, saying how any specific war fits into the bigger story is always really difficult. I mean, one of the things historians always like to say is, of course, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight when we're trying to make sense of things. But say, I mean, you think about something like the First World War, breaks out 100 years ago. If you look at World War One right from the perspective, say, right after the end of the war, it's very hard to see any positive stuff coming out of World War One. But on the other hand, if you step back and look at it from our perspective now, World War One looks much more like the first round in a 75-year series of struggles over the control of Europe. You get World War One, World War Two, then the Cold War. And the end result of all that is you've got a much more stable order has appeared. People are much wealthier than they had been before the war started. They're living, on average, 30 years longer now in Europe than they did 100 years ago. And I think perspective makes all the difference with these things. And yeah, and living through the wars is a very different thing from looking back on them from centuries later.
I think that's probably a gut reaction that you get a lot. I mean, when you think of not just the death from war, but the suffering of people in the military, civilians, mm-hmm. Affected by war, displaced by war, in Syria today, and any war we could name almost at random. When you weigh all that in there, it seems really hard to make this positive argument.
Yeah, I think the question you've always got to ask yourself is, okay, what would the alternative be? I mean, like you say, you're talking about any particular war. The alternative is, of course, going to be a lot less killing that's going on if the war hadn't broken out. But when you look at the 10,000-year story, because, you know, it seemed to me that really no other force except war has been enough to create these bigger, more peaceful organizations. The alternative, if somehow there'd been no process leading to the creation of the bigger, stronger states, the alternative would be we would still be living in a world much like the Stone Age, where we are facing, you know, a 10 to 20% chance of dying violently. Our lives would be much nastier, brutish, and shorter, like Hobbes said, than they are as a result. So again, you know, I think that's, you've always got to ask yourself, okay, what is the alternative to this?
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Ripon. Mike, hi. Mike, are you there? No, we've lost Mike. Let's try Tony over in Wallace, Michigan now. Tony, hi.
Yes, my question is armed revolution against the government as profitable as war against another country, or is it strictly profitable against another country?
Ian, I mean,
yeah,
that's what's profitable, I think, but...
I think that's a great question, though, because you know, writing this book, trying to understand the big picture history of war, while you know, I'm claiming that the big overall effect has been that war has pushed the world to being this safer, more prosperous place, of course, not all wars move the world in that direction. And the reason that some wars lead us toward a more kind of peaceful, prosperous state is that those wars are ones that have tended to produce the bigger societies with the more stable governments, you know, the Roman Empire, places like this. Not all wars do that, though. And on the whole, civil wars tend not to do that. And, you know, Syria, I think, is a great example of this. You know, it's now starting to look like the Assad government may end up, in fact, winning this war. But for a long time, people were saying, you know, the most likely outcome here is that Syria is going to split into three countries. They're going to be smaller, they're going to be less stable, they're going to be more violent, they're going to be poorer. Often, I think, when we're looking at a civil war, what we're looking at here is the breakdown of a fairly large society with a stable stable government and reasonably high levels of peace and prosperity within it. They start falling apart. The violence makes people less safe. So again, you know, I think to understand how a particular war fits into the big story, you've always got to have some context.
You know, looking into the future, does the argument you're making justify a future powerful nation in wars of conquest and expansion? We're breaking some eggs here, but the outcome is going to be a bigger state that guarantees a pax, whatever the country is called, of the future.
Yeah, well, I think this is kind of the twist in the tale, the twist in the end of the story here, that the story I'm telling is you know, about how over 10,000 years the world has moved in the direction of safety and prosperity. And yet one of the great paradoxes in the story is that we've now reached a point where you know, the organizations we've created are so big, so effective, and the weapons we've made are so destructive that another great war of the kind we've had in the 20th century, say, which you know, in theory you might say, oh, well, that will lead to a world state, a world government, much more peace and prosperity. We can't have a war of that kind. Another war of that kind could potentially kill everybody on the planet. And so this, I think, is the great challenge that I tried to confront at the end of the book. Where is the 21st century likely to take us? And I think that one of the there's a lot of speculations you can make, but I think one big lesson you can draw, though, is that in the short term, the most important force for peace is a continuing kind of globocop overseeing the world order. And you know, in the world we live in at the moment, the only candidate for that job is the United States. So the book, you know, I suggest very strongly that the U.S., in spite of a lot of the things people overseas say about the U.S., the U.S. is the greatest force for peace and prosperity and stability in the world today.
In your book, you, I think, make the case that hasn't been a straight-line movement. There have been peaks and valleys and peace and violence. It seems like one other alternative to what you just outlined is collapse of superpowers somewhere down the road and a new version of a Dark Ages of some sort where the kind of violence you're worried about increases.
Yeah, this is the pessimistic projection, of course. I think the ending of the book is, on the whole, fairly optimistic. I mean, it seems to me that humans, we can't wish war out of existence. We've been trying to do that for millennia. We can't wish war out of existence. But on the other hand, we are very good at responding to changes in the world we live in and recognizing when violence has payoffs that might potentially be positive, when it's just totally negative across the board. And we've been very good, I think, at reacting to these payoffs. And I would say that's the main reason why the Cold War ended as it did, rather than with a thermonuclear war breaking out and killing everybody. The Soviet leadership basically wakes up in the 1980s and says, you know, force is never going to solve our problems. And retreating from Eastern Europe might be a disaster for Russia, but it's better than the alternatives. And I think people are, on the whole, very good at recognizing these changing payoffs. But the scary thing, of course, is we're not perfect at doing it. And the world we live in now, the kind of weaponry we've got now, a single major mistake could mean catastrophe for everybody. So while I think the story has a positive ending, I think we're going in a very good direction, nothing is guaranteed.
So you, in making this kind of controversial argument, you come out with a fairly optimistic picture of our future in the next 50 years or so.
I do, yeah. I mean, I suggest in my book that the next half century is likely to be the most dangerous in the whole of human history, in that I think we can see all kinds of trends that suggest that maybe the American ability to kind of police a global order is beginning to weaken and break down. We're getting ever more destructive and powerful weapons appearing all the time. And this is a really, really scary combination. But on the other hand, you know, the big long-term trends do suggest that we are pretty good at working out our problems and moving the world in this positive direction. So, yeah, it's a fairly upbeat ending to the book.
All right, if we could just make it through that next 50 years. Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. I spent a very happy year living out between Blanchardville and New Glarus in the early 1990s. So it's great to be back in Wisconsin virtually, at least.
All right, well, hope you can visit us again. That was Ian Morris, professor of classics and professor of history at Stanford University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called War. What is it good for?
What is it good for?
Absolutely.
Now listen to me.